Hi, welcome to Open Mic. I'm your host, Leanne Akers, and today we are talking with an Appalachian author, Beth Macy, about her new book, Dope Sick. Beth, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me, Leanne.
I saw a little blurb about your new book, Dope Sick, and I guess let's just talk to start with about how you got the idea of Dope Sick, where that name came from, and what inspired you to write this book.
Well, I was a longtime reporter up until 2014 at the Roanoke Times in Virginia here, and I wrote a three-part series about heroin, particularly as it was landing in the white, wealthy suburbs around the city in a region called Hidden Valley, ironically, because people had the money, they were able to hide their addictions longer. And I had written two books after that, and I was casting about for a third idea. And by that point, which would have been about 2015, the heroin epidemic was in the news every day. Of course, in Appalachia, we have been dealing with the opioid crisis for much longer than that. And so I decided to tell the story basically by going deep in three Virginia communities, which I feel represent the arc of the epidemic as I witnessed it, landing from rural Lee County, which is in the heart of central Appalachia, it's our westernmost county, to Roanoke in the cities and suburbs, where I personally picked up the story, in 2012, and then more recently to farm towns up the northern Shenandoah Valley.
I think that a lot of people have a misconception about what has caused the opioid crisis, especially in Appalachia. What do you think is something that was a catalyst for it here?
Purdue Pharma, the introduction of OxyContin, the incredible mistruths which with that drug was presented initially to doctors, and how so much money was spent in marketing it to doctors, especially in rural areas like Appalachia, where there had been a lot of workplace injuries and a lot of people had legitimate pain issues because of working in the mines, because of working in furniture factories and logging and fishing up in Maine and places like that. And so when the reps were sent out in 1996 and in the late 90s, they targeted areas where there were already a lot of opioid prescribing that was happening with these much lower dosage opioids, such as Percocet, Vicodin, Lortab. And they pitched these doctors with the notion that OxyContin was safer than those immediate-release opioids because it had a time-release mechanism that was supposed to bleed out over 12 hours. And that made it, the FDA allowed them to make this squishy claim that the time-release mechanism made it less likely for a person. It was believed to reduce the liability of abuse, quote, because of the mechanism. And, of course, they had done no studies. The FDA required them to do no long-term studies showing that was true. And then by the time the marketing team at Purdue got a hold of that and sort of used some old data to buttress that claim, and then it was repeated in doctors' offices all across the country, but it was particularly harmful to these distressed rural areas in Appalachia, where people were already on a lot of pain meds, and the difference was they could function before, but once OxyContin came along, it was so strong that people became unfunctioning people. And then there was a lot of illicit sales of it as well, because people were desperate and the jobs were going away and they could talk somebody into writing them a prescription for OxyContin and make thousands of dollars selling some of it, taking the rest.
I know growing up in this area and the daughter of a coal miner, I remember my father coming home when I was a teenager and saying to my mother, so-and-so, well, he tested dirty for drugs today and lost his job. And I remember thinking at that time, why would somebody give up such a good paying job to take care of their family for prescription pills? To me at the time, it didn't make any sense. Did you see anything like that happening when you were doing the research for this book?
Oh, absolutely. Because see, once people got prescribed this drug and they were, not just 3 days like what's recommended now, but they're prescribed like months-long treatment courses of OxyContin. And of course, we know now that after a few days, after a week on this drug, you can, if you just stop taking it, you can have withdrawal symptoms. And that's why I called the book Dope Sick. That's what's driving. I mean, you have the economic drivers as well, but this drug was so powerful that coal miners and farmers in their 60s and 70s were starting to lose their families early on. I'm talking late 90s, early aughts, losing their families, their farms, losing their lives to murder and drug deals gone bad. I mean, a rate of crime never before seen in some of these communities, jail stacking up. One farmer traded his family's mule for 4 OxyContin pills. I mean, and then when it gets to the suburbs in Roanoke, the people have the money to hide it longer, right? Because they can say, oh, mom, somebody stole my iPad at school, not I pawned my iPad to get it money for drugs. And the parents who were in on the, quote, dirty little secret had the money to send their kids up to rehab and were too ashamed because of the stigma, which is huge, still is huge, to let their neighbors know. And so you see in both kinds of localities, the epidemic is allowed to fester and grow.
Now, do you think that there's enough awareness of this being such a problem that people are kind of approaching rehabilitation in a different way, or do you think we still have to fight against a stigma?
Well, I think it's getting a little better, but I think stigma is very powerful. I mean, shame is such a powerful emotion. What I see is that people who are in good treatment programs on medication-assisted treatment like methadone or buprenorphine, they're often stigmatized as being, quote, unclean. And, I mean, I think that's a place where we could do a lot more education. And I hope my book helps inform people that if you're on MAT and you're in a good program and you're getting counseling, I mean, there's so many people who are getting their lives back. They're getting the kids back. They're going back to school. They're even getting off disability. And this isn't everyone. This is because it's not a perfect cure-all, right? And there are a lot of issues with diversion and abuse of Suboxone, too. But the data shows very clearly that people on MAT, Suboxone or methadone in particular, are 50 to 60% less likely to die of overdose. And I think because of the stigma about it, largely because of abstinence-only treatment centers and AA and NA communities that don't believe they think you're just replacing one drug with another, because of that very set stigma, those people are afraid to tell their stories, and they're afraid to come out. Like, I have people that I interviewed in the book that are real success stories, but they asked me not to use their name. And I think that's telling that the biggest stigma now is, like, I mean, it's not just in the people that use the drugs, it's also in the people that are using the medication responsibly. And, you know, they feel very stigmatized about it.
Now, medication-based rehabilitation, I think that there's a lot of misconceptions about that. One of the questions I have is, if somebody takes Suboxone to help them get off these opioids, is that something that they have to take forever?
Well, the science isn't clear on that. One drug addiction specialist told me, if you were addicted for 5 years to opioids, then you should be on Suboxone 10 years. I don't know that that's true. Some people, like Nora Volko at the National Institutes of Drug Abuse, she believes it's okay if people are on them for the rest of their lives, that it's not unlike a diabetic being on insulin. I followed the travails of a country doctor in Lee County, Virginia, named Dr. Art Benzie, who was a real pioneer. He was also one of the first to beg Purdue Pharma to take the drug off the market until it could be redeveloped to be abuse resistant. They declined. He has been a Suboxone prescriber since 2003, almost since the beginning. He has patients that he's had for 8-10 years stable on the drug, and he's afraid that if he takes them off, even if they're just taking 0.5 milligram a day, they're still vulnerable to relapse. And so he doesn't recommend, unless they really want to do it, then he says, okay, let's try it. But he keeps in touch with them, and I think he's like the People should go to Lee County. People should send their med students to Lee County to study how he does it, because he's doing it exactly the right way in companionship with therapy, really good therapy. And he spends a lot of time with his patients. But there aren't enough doctors like him that are willing to become waivers to prescribe Suboxone because, you know, they don't want, quote, addicts in their waiting room. Not that they, you know, when they, we all know they probably already have, quote, addicts, and I don't like to use that word, that's what I'm saying, quote, in their waiting room. And they helped us get, doctors, whether they knew it or not, they helped us get into this mess, this opioid crisis. And I think they should feel morally compelled to help get us out of it.
Was there any particular story while you were researching this book that made you feel like, yes, this is definitely something that needs to be written, that needs to be shared with the world?
Yeah, well, every story was a heartbreak to me. There are very few success stories. I mean, there are some success stories with MAT. There are a few success stories that I write about. There's one local surgeon and his civic leader wife, you know, they spent $300,000 to send their two heroin addicted sons off to these long-term treatment centers in other states that were abstinence only. And they're doing well. I mean, I'm happy to report, but that's only 10 to 11% of abstinence only treatments are successful. And so they're miracles to me. There's another young man I write about who was very successful on Suboxone. He's now getting his PhD. He's got a full ride. Getting his PhD in addiction science. He also didn't want me to use his name because he's been on Suboxone and he feels he will be stigmatized because he's, quote, in recovery. And, I mean, all these stories, we lost 72,000 people last year to opioid overdose, likely an undercount. And numbers are still going up in most states. And every one of those stories is a tragedy, not just for the people lost, but for the families and friends.
I think a lot of people are not talking about the prescription pill abuse as much now as the heroin crisis. At least in Eastern Kentucky, it seems like it's a little more prevalent. But as a journalist, as you know, when you're covering these things, you kind of start seeing the patterns as they just rotate. This week,
yeah, and now you have a lot of meth related. Crime and addiction as well. The young woman I follow from the wealthy suburbs of Roanoke, you know, her family sends her out to Las Vegas for abstinence-only rehab. She bombs out of that. Her name is Tess. She's 28 years old. She's living on the streets in Las Vegas, homeless, prostituting, and, you know, living in this world of criminal gangs and prostitution rings, and she ends up murdered on Christmas Eve. And I mean, just what a heartbreak at every juncture. But her family was so riven over the best way for her to get better. And, you know, they sent her to this treatment that turned out to be exactly the wrong kind of treatment for her. And this is what people are ending up in. She was also using a lot of meth. You know, her mother and I went out to Las Vegas in April to do some more reporting and research, and her mother is really looking for clues and closure because her murder remains unsolved. And we spent a lot of time with homeless people who live in the communities under the city out in Las Vegas, which, you know, many of them take meth in order to get up to go get their heroin dose for the day, right? I mean, it's like a combo thing. And a lot of the homeless people out there take meth because they're afraid if they go to sleep at night, someone will steal their stuff. And so it's just one of the things I love about Kentucky is that you're a little ahead of the game on harm reduction services. I just wrote a profile of Robert Geit, who's an artist and harm reductionist from Harlan, Kentucky, who has done this series of plays called Higher Ground. I don't know if you've seen any of them, but they're amazing plays. They started in 2005, set against the backdrop of the opioid crisis. And his latest is called Needlework. And it's all about trying to get communities receptive to the idea of opening syringe exchanges, which can be these easy access portals for addicted people to receive not just clean needles, but also disease testing for hepatitis C and HIV. And then referrals to treatment for those diseases, as well as treatment for for their opioid use disorder and their meth problems. And Kentucky has, in the last time I checked, more than 30 syringe exchange and recovery programs. And Virginia only has one. And even though the legislature approved it a year and a half ago or so, it's still such a political non-starter in many communities because of holdups among law enforcement. So kudos to Kentucky.
There was some controversy and there was some kickback. People had that not in my neighborhood mentality because there was a stigma. They didn't want to admit that it was happening.
They see it as enabling. And I think if you just take a little time to study it, and don't study the ones that tend to make the news are the ones that are poorly run and end up being a disaster. I mean, there's just a handful of them, but there are so many well-run ones that help get these dirty needles off the street. I mean, my friend was walking her kids to school back in May, and they ran across 3 heroin needles. My nephew, who lives in a little distressed town in Ohio, said we were having chili dogs at this little roadside stand, and we were going to walk across the street to the park. And he said, "Aunt Beth, can we drive?" And I was like, "Why? The park's right there. Let's just walk." And he goes, "I don't want to step on a heroin needle." I mean, he's 11 years old. These things are out there. Let's get them off the streets and let's start treating these people, some of whom are addicted through basically no fault of their own. I mean, especially the people who were initially prescribed these opioids. And let's get them help. Let's bring them in, because it's going to be more costly to wait until they're dying and then spend hundreds of thousands on a hepatitis C case. Let's get them treatment while there's still a chance to turn their lives around.
And on that note, I'm going to take a really quick break here on Open Mic. We'll be right back after this.
Bring the family to Morehead State University's annual Browning Orchard Festival at the Browning Orchard in Fleming County, noon to 4 p.m. on Sunday, September 30th. The event is free and open to the public. Hay rides, pony rides, a kid's maze, pig roast, and music by the Kentucky Center for Traditional Music. Apples, pumpkins, cider, mums, and other Kentucky Proud items for sale. Come to the MSU Browning Orchard Festival in Fleming County, noon to 4 p.m. on Sunday, September 30th.
Today we're talking with author and journalist Beth Macy about her new book, Dope Sick. Beth, thanks so much for being on the show.
Thanks for having me, Leanne.
One of the things that you mentioned earlier in talking about addiction is treatment options. And you're a proponent of finding the option that works for you, or for the addict that's in question.
Absolutely, because not every treatment plan works for every person. Everybody experiences addiction differently. And a lot of it depends on how many resources you have. You know, the family that had $300,000 to send their kids to these very long-term rehabs and aftercares, I mean, that's going to be different from somebody living, paycheck to paycheck or on disability. It's just going to be different.
That's something that I thought was interesting, and I don't know if you're even aware of the program. Here in Kentucky, there's a new law that was passed that allows family members to request mandatory, it doesn't have to be consensual, rehabilitation. What kind of information did you come up with in your researching for this book about addicts who are sent to rehabilitation before they make the decision to do it on their own?
Yeah, and I had some local recovery advocates that I was following who started this program to divert people from jail to treatment who were proponents of that. So I did some research on it, and most of the research, and again, this has been about 6 months ago that I finished the book and I was, you know, kind of updating everything. Most of the research at that time indicated that mandatory without the person's buy-in wasn't as successful. So I get that families are just at their wit's end, and I'm not going to judge anybody for taking advantage of this new law. I would need to study it more to see exactly how it's being framed and executed before I weighed in on that. But I totally empathize with families who, you know, believe that's their only recourse for keeping their loved one alive.
I think that there's no one in our community who hasn't been touched by addiction in some way. Everyone knows someone, mm-hmm. is friends, is family members with someone who has an addiction yeah. problem. And so I think that sometimes it is true. Families get to that point where they're at their wit's end and they just don't know what other option there is. And they're terrified that they're going to come in and find a family member or a friend who has overdosed.
And y'all had lost so many people out, you know, in Central Appalachia. I mean, I was interviewing when I was doing that piece on Robert Guype in Harlan. I was interviewing one of the cast members of Needlework, and she's a public defender in Harlan. And she said, you know, we have lost so many people that we talk about putting up a memorial wall in Harlan. And when you say everyone knows somebody, y'all are the canaries in the coal fields, right? I believe that the rest of the country needs to pay more attention to what's happened there, because it's eventually going to be happening everywhere, right? I mean, addiction already is happening everywhere, but I think if we want to really try to get, I don't want to say ahead of it, because we're already so far behind. If we could just catch up with it in this country, we could learn a lot from what Central Appalachia has been experiencing almost since the beginning of this epidemic.
Appalachians are a resourceful people, and we kind of have a tendency to go, okay, this is a problem and we need to fix it. And you can see throughout the history since the mid to late 90s when this issue first arose is to face head on the problem of prescription pill addiction, and be it rehabilitation with abstinence only or medicine-based rehabilitation, faith-based rehabilitation, a lot mm-hmm. of the AA meetings and that sort of thing. It's in every community now.
Every community, and as you say, more than likely almost every family has had some experience with it.
One of the things that I think is interesting from a journalistic perspective is the fact that a lot of times overdoses are not reported the same way as we report, like, drug crime.
We need more reporting. Yeah. I mean, even the drug crime in our paper, the Roanoke Times, which I used to work at, like, if you just pull the string and make a few more calls and a few more questions, most of the crime, not just the drug crime, most of the crime goes back to drug addiction. I think that should be more transparent. I think we need more reporting, but of course what you're seeing all over the country is a decline in regional media, and that worries me a lot.
And I think ignoring the fact that people do die from drug overdoses maybe contributes not only to the stigma of, oh, this family has a problem with drug addiction because their husband, son, wife, daughter overdosed, but also to kind of make it more people aware that it's more common than you think. It's very easy to overdose.
Very easy to overdose, yeah. And I do think every household should have Narcan in the medicine cabinets, and every household should go through their medicine cabinets and get out those pills that are left over from a back surgery or a knee replacement or whatever. We've all had them in our cabinets from time to time. But to your point about the media, you know, we've had large-scale heroin ring prosecutions in our federal court here in Roanoke that got virtually no coverage. How do I know this? Because I didn't read it in the Roanoke Times. I ran into a judge at Kroger who told me. He says, I can't get the paper to cover it. They don't have enough people to cover it. So, I mean, that worries me because then people don't know this is happening in their community. And it's very similar to what you just described. Overdose is not being reported. I mean, you see a lot of families that are just tired of it. And when they lose a loved one, they're just putting it out there now in their obituaries. So-and-so died of the disease of addiction. I think that's fantastic. I'm horrified that it comes to that. But I'm just so heartened by families that are willing to come out and talk about the problems, because until we start talking about this issue, the way we talk about cancer, you know, it's just going to be there buried underneath the rug, and that's not doing anyone any good.
Well, Beth, thank you so much for being on the show. I really appreciate you taking the time to talk with us today.
Oh, you're a fantastic interviewer, Leanne. Thank you so much.
Thank you. And that's all we've got for today here on Open Mic. We'll see you next Friday.